listening to Human Rights 2020s, a podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording of a webinar called Our International Human Rights, the CRPD, and features Cathy Asante, Legal Officer at the Scottish Human Rights Commission. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to what is the first in our series of lunchtime webinars around our international human rights. And of course, this first one today, we're going to look at the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which is quite a long title. So welcome to this webinar. So if I've not met you before, my name is Vari Snowden. I'm the Director of the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. The consortium is Scotland's civil society network to defend and promote human rights. As many of you know, we've been quite involved around the Scottish Human Rights Bill, of which some of the treaties that we're talking about in these lunchtime webinar series are going to be a core part. And without further ado, I would just like to invite our expert speaker for today, who is Cathy Asante, who is an legal officer with the Scottish Human Rights Commission. So Cathy, thank you for joining us. Thank you for giving us your time. Do you want to introduce yourself to everyone a little bit first and tell people also about the commission?
Absolutely, thanks. And thanks for inviting me along today. So I am a legal officer at the Scottish Human Rights Commission. And for those of you who don't know who we are Scotland's national human rights institution. We were set up by Parliament and we're accountable to Parliament. And our mandate is to protect and promote human rights in Scotland. My role there is as legal officer. I am a lawyer by background. Prior to working at the commission, I was a mental health and incapacity lawyer. That is about 10 years ago now, because I have been with the commission for approximately 10 years. So my interest in disability issues is very long-standing. While at the Commission, I've done a lot of work, particularly around mental health and incapacity, but also disability rights in general. And I generally take the lead around CRPD on our internal work.
Brilliant. Well, it's brilliant to have you here today. And the way this is going to work for everyone's sake is I'm just going to ask Cathy quite a lot of questions around the CRPD, what it means, what it includes, and then we'll take questions from folks here as well. But to start off with, you know, sometimes I think in the human rights things, it is full of quite complicated sounding treaties and a lot of acronyms, usually which have four letters, sometimes more, actually. So it can be quite complicated. And here's a classic, so UNCRPD. Can you just give us in a nutshell, what is that? What is it? What is the UNCRPD? What is the treaty all about?
Okay. So the first thing to say is that it is a treaty of the United Nations, and human rights treaties set out a series of human rights that people are entitled to, and this one is for disabled people. I suppose that's the very simple explanation of what it is. And it starts with a very obvious, I think, idea, probably to everybody who's here, which is that disabled people are full and equal members of society and entitled to the same rights as anyone else. But really, what it does is acknowledges that that is often not the experience of disabled people. So for the first time, the treaty sets out a set of human rights and a set of steps about what is required to actually make sure that those human rights are a reality for disabled people. It brings a lot of specificity to what human rights for disabled people actually means. And it operates on a social model of disability, which again is probably familiar to the people who are listening along today. But in short, it is built around the idea that people are disabled by a society that doesn't accommodate them rather than being disabled purely by their medical condition. And that's fundamental to the entire approach of the treaty. And then really what it does is it sets out specific efforts to identify when there are barriers to disabled people enjoying their rights and specific steps that need to be taken to remove those barriers. And ultimately, it's about working towards a world where disabled people are able to enjoy their human rights on an equal basis with others.
Thanks, that's really helpful. So, I mean, there are a whole number of international, you know, UN rights treaties. So presumably those apply to disabled people as well, but are there particular reasons that they have there this Disabled People's Rights Treaty as well?
Yes. So you're absolutely right. There are core treaties that apply to everybody in a population. And the human rights framework starts in the post-World War II period, 1948. We have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and that sets out human rights that apply to everybody universally. But then over time, there has been recognition that not everybody is starting in the same place and being able to access their rights. And a number of groups, mainly because of systems of discrimination in society, face additional barriers to accessing their rights. So over time, the countries of the world and the United Nations have identified women, people experiencing racial discrimination, the particular needs of children. And then most recently, this treaty around the rights of disabled people, which is a recognition that actually there are lots of particular barriers that disabled people face that aren't covered by general rights. And so they need to be actually identified, articulated, and pulled apart so that disabled people can have the additional steps that may be required to make sure that they're actually experiencing their rights. And then we could talk about this more, but when you actually look at CRPD, that becomes quite clear that there are some really particular things that apply to disabled people that don't apply to everybody else, particular barriers that they face or support that they require as a consequence of being disabled. So really that's all of the detail that is set out in CRPD that you don't find in general treaties.
That's really helpful. And I suppose it links to what you're saying about that social model of disability, that actually society is set up in a way that right now disabled people face lots of barriers. So unless there was this specific treaty, those might be ignored or action not taken on them and everything that gives that sort of a really solid base. I was reading recently about the number of disabled people who campaigned for a long time for this convention to be in place. I think it was agreed to by the UK back in 2009 as a Disabled People's Bill of Rights. And there was a real support and sort of massive kind of a level of support as something that disabled people themselves can use
Yeah,
and can get behind.
absolutely. And I mean, this treaty only exists because of the advocacy of disabled people. They pushed for it, they drafted it, they were absolutely at the core of it, saying that something specific is needed for disabled people because otherwise they're going to get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. So I was also reading this week, or was it last week, about the U a UN committee on rights of disabled people, basically saying that the UK is not improving on disabled people's rights. If anything, they're going backwards. So there's this feeling of we've got this treaty, it's kind of international level, but does anything, how do we make sure that actually happens? Like what pressure is on the UK government and the Scottish government, all the government to put it into practice and have to actually implement it?
I'm going to start with the last part of that first because I think that recent report actually really points to quite a lot of what is important about how we implement CRPD in Scotland. So the UK has been signed up to CRPD since 2009. It's a long time. And when states sign up to a treaty, they accept that they will do all of the things the treaty says, put in place steps and plans and actions to make sure that all of those rights are being delivered. And that includes, I should say, all governments in the state. So it also includes Scottish government when we're talking about devolved things like health or education and transport, etc. But the slight flaw in that is that it relies on governments actually doing that, taking that obligation seriously and taking all of those steps. And it's fair to say that that's not always the case when there are lots of other priorities that governments have on their mind. So, is it enough for a government to say, we will do this, just trust us on it? And what happens if they don't? At the moment, the extent to which they're actually actioning CRPD is monitored by a UN committee, as you say, so the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Each treaty has its own committee that monitors it. And they will look at all of the countries that have signed up to the treaty from time to time to say, here's what you're doing well, here's what you're not doing well, here's what you need to do next. And they issue a kind of report card for those countries. That happens about every 5 years. And sometimes when that happens, you get a big focus on thinking about disabled people's rights at the time of that review, but then there'll be another 5 years before they look again. That report card that they give does have a lot of really important information about what needs to happen next, but it still relies on the government actually taking it seriously enough to do those things. The report you mentioned from last week is a really good example of this. So that goes back to an inquiry in the committee did, and it was the first ever inquiry that they did in 2016. And it was in the wake of all of the welfare reform actions that had been taken, mainly at UK government level, but with implications in devolved nations too, and the impact that that had on disabled people's rights. And after a very extensive inquiry, they found that there were grave and systemic human rights violations for disabled people. That is a very stark finding. And they reviewed that recently and put out the report last week and said, as you say, nothing has really changed. Not enough has been done, and not all of the options available to the states, including the Scottish government, have been taken. So those types of findings are, they put pressure on the government. They are very important, but they have a limitation because they still go back to government to enact. So that's the monitoring is very important, but actual enforcing of the rights is a different matter.
That's really helpful. It's almost that there is a tool there, but it's a little bit weak in terms of actually making sure there's action to implement the treaty. I do think that phrase about grave and systemic violations of disabled people's human rights is really stark, isn't it? So when we're talking about then disabled people's rights that are in the RPD, can you tell us what some of those are, to give us an idea of what are the sorts of things that are in the CRPD? What are some of the really kind of not though they're all important, but some of the headline rights? Yeah.
Absolutely. This might be quite a long answer. So there are 33 articles in CRPD that are setting out specific rights, essentially. And they cover all areas of life. So it's a very wide range of things. And generally, they cover the same rights as the treaties that look at the whole population, but they build on that to give lots more specific detail for disabled people. And they pick out some particular rights that apply to disabled people that you don't find in other treaties. To avoid going through what they all are, I thought it'd be helpful to sort of pick up on some key themes that I think are fundamental to CRPD. The first one is about participation of disabled people. So there's a specific obligation in the treaty that in developing anything that affects disabled people, that they must be involved and closely consulted. And that applies across all the treaty and anything that's being done around disabled people. But then there are a whole series of rights that are really about making sure that participation is a reality in lots of areas of life. So in political and public life, in cultural life and recreation and sport, in work, in employment, in being able to participate in your community. All of that is spelled out in individual rights. And then that links to, I'd say, the sort of central idea of CRPD, something that it picks up just as very fundamental to the lives of disabled people, which is independence and autonomy. And really that's reflected throughout every single right of the treaty. And there are some particular rights that talk about that explicitly. So there's the right to live independently and participate in the community, which is set out in detail as a right. There's the right to be equally recognised by the law. And what that is about disabled people being able to make decisions for themselves instead of those decisions being made by other people. And that their wishes and preferences are to be respected, and that if they require support in order to make those decisions, that they would be provided with that support. And so those rights are really trying to hone in on the specific parts of independence and autonomy. And again, that's reflected in lots of other rights. And then there are some that are about setting out what particular support might be required for disabled people that, again, you wouldn't see in a general treaty. So particular aspects of health, like early identification of health conditions to minimise further disability, support around personal mobility, support around habilitation and rehabilitation. These are all about additional support services that might be required, and making sure that they are provided and provided in a way that allows for independence and autonomy. And then the other thing that you'd see in CRPD is protection of rights that are not to be taken for granted. So again, we all have these rights, but the right to a home and family life, to protection from abuse, to the right to life, core human rights, but also rights that can be more in jeopardy for disabled people than for other people as well. So there's particular protections of some of those fundamental rights as well. There's lots more, but I would say those are the kind of themes that you would find across the treaty.
That's really helpful. There is a lot, isn't there? There is a lot, and there's a real mixture of a lot of those rights specifically require governments to do something, and often to use resource in order to do that as well. You know, that is, and then some of them are, like you're saying, almost particularly where disabled people rights to things, like you're saying, that we all take for granted are particularly at risk. So there's a little bit of the government of not to do things or to particularly protect in certain areas.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, there's the refraining from doing things that interfere with disabled people's lives, and there's the positive action. A lot of it is around positive action, and generally it's about the way it's kind of set out is about taking steps and making sure that services are provided, and you know, making sure implied that there's budget to do that. So it is very proactive. It's a series of proactive steps, and I think it's actually one of the more accessible treaties in that way, because it's got loads of detail. It doesn't just say you have a right to health. It says you have a right to health. That means, you know, five key things you have to do X, Y, Z to make sure that that happens for disabled people. It's a lot more specific than I think sometimes people think human rights can be a bit vague until you look into all the detail behind it. But a lot of this is in the treaty itself.
And that helpful kind of get quite specific. It's quite challenging, I think it'd be fair to say. A lot of the areas really hit on areas where rights are particularly at risk. And there have been, we can send out links to this, that also the UN committee has produced lots of what are called general comments, which are kind of guidance that even go into more detail on some of those rights. So sometimes I think things at an international level can seem very vague, but actually in terms of some of the areas of CRPD, there is quite a lot of detail about what the government's doing. And that's useful to know, isn't it? Because actually that's what we can use, that's what disabled people can use, we can all use in terms of our advocacy and holding the government to account.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think it's when you get to the specifics, when it says do these particular things, that's when human rights becomes real, and that's when we can actually say what is and isn't being done. Anytime that the committee has actually set out what a right means and what they want to see, you can almost take that straight to whoever the public authority is here and say, tell us what you're doing. I think it's really helpful in that way.
That's really helpful. One of the rights that comes up a lot in consortium discussions is around that right to independent living, maybe because it is really particularly at risk for so many people. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the treaty says around that particular right?
And that's one where there is a lot of detail from a general comment, and the committee set out exactly what it expects to see happen to make independent living a reality. To try and sum it up, because it is, as you say, it's a right that you don't find in any other treaties. That's exactly the sort of benefit of CRPD. It's articulating this for the first time. And I'd say that the key elements of it, firstly, choice and control. It's about having the right to choose where you live, who you live with, and the support to make that happen. And when they talk about choice and control, they mean in all aspects of your life. So not just where you live and who you live with, but also your day-to-day decisions. Do you actually have autonomy over your life? And are you able to choose how to live your life in the way that you would if you were not disabled? It also has a right to individualized support. So not general support, not support that's just provided to people that have a particular type of condition, but individualized support that enables you to live your life independently in the way that you wish. And that is a right. It's not a charitable thing to give. It's actually the right of disabled people, which I think is quite an important thing about this. And there's a strong focus on moving away from institutions as a form of care as well. And when we're talking about detail, the committee has a whole set of guidelines that actually specifies exactly what they want to see in terms of ending institutions as a form of care. And when they talk about institutions, they mean anywhere where you don't have choice and control over what happens on a daily basis, and you're forced to accept particular living arrangements that you have not necessarily chosen. And it says those have to be replaced with independent living and individual support services. And then it's got a broader aspect that's about making sure that you can live in the community, so that actually communities are accessible and disabled people aren't just supported in their own home, but are able to live their lives independently in the world as well. And I think just once you start to look at that and the opposite of that, you can see why it's so important in Scotland. There are lots of people who are not able to live independently at present. I mean, situations that would not be independent living are anybody who's living in an institution. We know there are people, particularly with learning disabilities and or autistic people, who are in institutions against their will and sometimes stuck there for long periods of time. You could be living in the community, but in a placement where you haven't actually chosen the setup, and you're perhaps in a small group arrangement just because people have the same needs as you, not because you actually want to live with them. That, again, wouldn't be independent living. You could be in a home arrangement, but one that's been chosen by someone else and is against your wishes. Or you could be living in your own home, but without enough support to actually be able to live your life independently, perhaps being stuck in the house, not able to access the community. So there's a whole range of situations, from sort of classic institutional care to people just facing barriers to being able to participate in their community that people face in Scotland in terms of independent living.
Thanks. That's really helpful. And just so stark that these are the rights that need to be in there, because we know that they're often at risk. Like you're saying, that actually a lot, you know, the far too many people are institutionalised, disabled people are institutionalised in Scotland. And it comes back to the core human rights principles of treating people with dignity, and closely related to that is people having agency over their own choices and where you live and who you live with is so kind of fundamental to that.
Yeah, and I think the basic idea is, why should it be any different than anybody else? Yeah. And I think I sometimes experience resistance to that there's an idea that some people can't live in the community because it's too difficult. And CRPD just completely rejects that idea. It says everybody is entitled to the same rights and can live in the community with adequate support, which I think is both challenging but also really empowering.
Yeah. I'm just going to come to a question that's in the chat box just now, because it's directly relevant to this. So the question is, would the right to independent living cover someone who has been long-term for many years under a compulsory treatment order in a secure ward? So obviously you can't go into details in terms of individuals, but in general, does that right apply to those sort of situations?
I mean, short answer, yes. Hospitals are institutions, and if you are there long term, then that is essentially your living arrangement. And so that would be contrary to the right to independent living. That doesn't necessarily mean that would enable people to immediately be discharged from hospital, but that there has to be a focus on moving people out from hospital and into the community. There is a recognition in CRPD that some things take time, but there has to be clear action towards moving in that direction. So people shouldn't be admitted to long-term placements in the first place. You have to stop admitting people, and then people who are there needs to be a plan to move them on into their own homes in the community.
Yeah, and I often think that some of the rights in the treaties are there in a you cannot ignore this and you need to keep getting better at it. You know, that actually is not going to be an immediate kind of solution, but here is a list of the things that you must see as important and you must take steps to improve on.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not a sort of a check box kind of thing. I'm just thinking about in terms of obviously. In Scotland, we're talking a lot about CRPD being brought into Scots law directly through incorporation. And we're talking about that at the same time as being aware of these very pressing issues for disabled people, where their rights are at risk. You know, there's loads, so much to be done to improve things. Are there particular areas of kind of law and policy in Scotland that you think would be impacted and improved if CRPD, if we took CRPD seriously, if we implemented it more fully, if it became a sort of core part of what we do?
I mean, there is so much that I don't want to do a disservice by not picking up on all the issues, but there are some that sort of spring to mind for me in particular. I think the first one, and this is partially on account of my background as a mental health lawyer, but again, it's fundamental to the treaty, that right around equal recognition before the law really needs to change in Scotland. So essentially, disabled people can have their right to make decisions taken away from them by mental health and incapacity law. If you were to take CRPD seriously, you would fundamentally reform that so that it's all about supporting people to make decisions. And we do have proposals from an independent review to do that, but that's yet to happen, and that is a sort of in the realm of a kind of long-term law reform thing. But actually, that's fundamental, is giving people back the right in all circumstances to make decisions for themselves. I think that there is a lot of potential around the National Care Service as it's being built to really be built around all of the aspects of the right to independent living. For me, I think that is absolutely the core right that should be at the heart of the National Care Service. And if you take the detail that's given by the committee, you can use that to build every aspect of the National Care Service, whether that's, the sort of standards it operates by, or the way that complaints are dealt with if people's rights are not being upheld. The whole design of what it is that is being commissioned and delivered to people can be built around human rights principles. So I think that's one where there's definitely more scope to use human rights and CRPD in a really practical, meaningful way at the ground level. I also have been looking a lot at places of detention recently, and I think there's a lot to be done in relation to criminal justice still. So in prisons, for example, there's a significant amount of disabled people and a lot of people with very high mental health needs who would be considered disabled under CRPD, but very little resourcing. The Mental Welfare Commission said that prison mental health care was underserved and under-resourced. And indeed, there are people who should be in hospital getting mental health care, but are in prisons, often in segregation units. So there are really stark circumstances like that as well, where if you were to look at what CRPD says, you would have to specifically monitor what's going on for starters, and then have a plan of action to remedy it. Those are just some, key areas that have been at the forefront of my mind, but I think there's potential across every article of the convention.
Yeah, and actually, from what you were saying there, it's really helpful to think about it as something that is useful for the design of how we do services and how we do policies. So sometimes there's a little bits of mentions of CRPD and other human rights treaties somewhere in the introduction to a policy or, you know, in different ways. But actually, as you're saying, that there are actually a practical tool that can make for good policy, good services that actually work for disabled people.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm increasingly saying we have to be specific. So it's nice to recognize that there is a treaty that we care about disabled people's rights, but it doesn't become meaningful until you get specific and you actually look at what does that mean we have to do that we've been told by these human rights. And that's the point where it actually means something.
Yeah, that really kind of touch. This is it. It's almost that naming of the rights and that detail. So we know that the Scottish Government have committed to introducing a Scottish Human Rights Bill, and in terms of CRPD, from what we know as yet, no one's seen the bill, so we don't really know what will end up looking like. But from the consultation proposals last year, they are suggesting that there'll be a couple of elements related to CRPD in there. So there'll be a duty to take into account CRPD in terms of how public services are run. That also, when public services or like local authorities are looking at how to implement what's called our economic and social rights, so things like the right to housing or the right to education or the right to health, that they need to think about CRPD. And specifically about how those rights apply to disabled people. We are not clear yet about whether there will be a duty to comply on CRPD as a whole or as some of the standalone rights within it. And certainly the consortium and disabled people's organisations and many others are advocating for that to be as strong as possible, because that's the enforcement bit. Isn't that's the actually enforceability and teeth related to human rights. Do you have any reflections on why that enforceability of disabled people's rights is important, or and what that could mean?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the enforceability is the key aspect of it. It's probably just important to say that there's a really big difference between, I think it's probably obvious, there's a big difference between a duty to consider or take something into account and a duty to comply with it. And a duty to comply is like what the Human Rights Act has, which is if you don't, there are consequences and you will ultimately can end up in court. There's also a duty to think about it throughout building policies and laws, but ultimately it's backed up by consequences. And that is the importance of this Human Rights Bill is about bringing accountability, because we know that international monitoring isn't sufficient. So the approach that's being proposed at the moment, as you say, is focusing on economic, social, and cultural rights, those universal rights for people. And, you know, that is also relevant to disabled people, but you're then losing all of the specificity that you get. And that was the reason that CRPD was drafted in the first place, is that the general stuff isn't enough. So why would CRPD rights have a lesser degree of protection than economic, social, and cultural rights in general, I think is the question to be answered. And yes, there is a complex legal situation to navigate there. You know, the government basically has to avoid straying into reserved areas, and they can't conflict with the Equality Act. There are some difficult legal questions to be answered there. But I do believe it's possible to identify rights that are really completely about devolved areas, things around, say, health or housing, or aspects that are completely within the control of the Scottish Government, that if you can put that into law and make people comply with it, then I think there's a real obligation to do so, because disabled people's rights are in jeopardy and as important as any of the other rights that are going into the bill. And I think that if it were enforceable, some areas where people could start to think about maybe pushing for that enforcement is thinking about social care charging policies, for example. Are those fair and equitable in every part of the country? Whether there's enough progress being made on getting people out of institutions. Whether this is a particular bugbear of mine, there's the fact that there's no independent investigation of any deaths in mental health detention. Is that acceptable? These are the types of things where I think if you had enforceable CRPD rights, you would actually be able to move the conversation forward and ultimately take it to court and hold people accountable if the rights aren't delivered.
Yeah, it's almost that those general human rights protections, yes, they are important for disabled people, but they don't cut it on their own, that you need that, like that, with specific rights you're saying, and that's what can really move the needle actually and really bring the accountability that disabled people need. That's really interesting and helpful to think about. I'm going to come to a couple of questions in the chat box. So from David at the Community Transport Association, I hope I've got that right. How can or should we as an organisation use the UNCRPD, so the Convention on Disabled People's Rights, when we're pushing or campaigning for better accessible transport for disabled people? We need to get national and local government to enforce and deliver on the right to personal mobility, but their decision-making feels so remote from the treaty. Mm-hmm. Any reflections on that, Catherine?
So I would say that the important thing to me for that and any area really is again going back to getting specific. So it would be, if you say that, if you were to ask the government to say to make sure that they're thinking about CRPD or complying with it in relation to accessible transport, or any public authority, they will likely tell you that they have. And you would need to have some wherewithal in order to be able to say, well, actually, this is what it would mean, and you have only done that bit and that bit, but not the other bits. So I think that starting to bring quite specific asks to those types of things is quite important in order to actually use it as advocacy. And, you know, some of the international treaties can be, the UN doesn't necessarily write in the easiest way to understand, but I think if you actually look to the treaty and then any additional guidance that's been given, then you can start to actually put a bit of flesh on the bones of these requests and then use that as an accountability tool, really, to say, to challenge claims that everything is being done in line with disabled people's rights.
Thanks. And it speaks to a lot about, you know, how do we use human rights in general as a tool to get change, isn't it? And there's different levers, whether it's the sort of UN recommendations about what the government has said before in terms of CRPD and the sort of rhetoric and raising it with policymakers and insisting on it and everything. But also just a recognition that actually if it's in the Human Rights Bill, that's when it comes, we would need the enforceability, because that's when it comes with the strongest accountability teeth to get these things done as well, where they're, and including having to report on what they're doing to comply with the CRPD, whereas at the moment that's a little bit vague and really, you know, there's not that same concrete kind of reporting that local authorities and government have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And they will have to do that when we hopefully get this bill passed. But I think that the mere fact that there's a bill coming actually is a reason for people to start thinking about it now. You know, by the time it becomes, you know, if it actually becomes enforceable, then there are risks if you haven't got your house in order. So I think there's a real impetus to start thinking about how the convention can be put into practice by public authorities now, because they will be forced to report on it in due course.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a question from Lorraine that is, can you speak about how treaties interplay with each other? I'm thinking about young disabled people and the UNCRC Act that's coming into force this summer. How do we maximise their rights in real life, which fall in two or more treaties?
Yes. I mean, basically, I would say use both, because you're going to get different detail in different ones. And generally speaking, they build on each other. They don't. There's very little conflict in incredibly niche areas where you might find slight conflict in treaties, and even that's only a matter of opinion. So I would say that identifying the rights that apply under both treaties, or yeah, whichever treaties apply to the people that you are working with, is really important. Because yes, if you just look at children under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, you're not going to get detail on disabled people. If you look at the Disability Convention, it does talk about children with disabilities, but the specific things that apply to children are in the other conventions. So I think it's a case of working with both and putting them all together. I mean, when we're approaching any area of work, what we usually start by doing is identifying all of the human rights that apply wherever they sit. And then it's just really a case of putting those all together and seeing what questions they pose.
Yeah. And actually, some of the rights within CRPD are stronger, I think, for children than under the UNCRC, such as the right to inclusive education. Is an additional and is more specific and is a sort of stronger right, I think.
Yeah, and I mean that's partly because CRPD is the most recent treaty, so it's just the most it's the most up to date thinking in terms of human rights, and things had moved on between the Convention on the Rights of the Child and CRPD in terms of something like education and what the expectations were around human rights. So I think it's always useful to look at in that regard because you're going to get the most up to date thinking.
And I suppose it's worth saying as well that there are other treaties which will feature in other lunchtime webinars. But for example, the convention on around rights related to race, the convention on women and girls' rights, actually, and a lot of those overlap and replicate each other and mirror, but also add additional things because so few of us fit within one box, but actually we've got multiple identities and overlapping barriers and that disadvantage us further. So there is a benefit, isn't it? And looking across the whole kind of framework of all these treaties kind of working together.
And I think even though we've said that, you know, the general treaties aren't specific enough, there's also a lot of really foundational important stuff in the general treaties as well that will always be of use. So I think that's those are a good starting point when we're looking at whatever area it is, whether it's an economic and social area like housing or health or something, or whether it's the other type of rights, which are called civil and political. So that's things like that, you know, the right to life, the right to private and family life. A lot of the foundations were built on those treaties. So there's still a lot there that's incredibly useful, even if it has been built on by CRPD.
There's a question around, can you share information which can support staff in the higher education system to improve accessibility in universities? Now, this could be a whole day event actually to go into all of that, I think. But do you have a couple of reflections on particular issues for making sure that disabled students have equal access to education and to participation and the different elements of being a university student, I guess.
It's not an area I know a huge amount about, so I'm thinking on my feet here. But I would imagine that one of the main challenges is around providing support services for people with different needs. And I don't know enough about the setting to know how that's actually provided, but I think that looking to CRPD would articulate what it should look like in education, but also except the right to accessibility sets out a lot of detail about how everything in society is made accessible, and that would include educational settings. And actually the right to rehabilitation and habilitation, that also talks about educational settings. If somebody needed support in order to come back to an educational setting or a workplace, that those are the types of services that would need to be provided. So they are definitely mentioned across articles of the convention, and those are probably the main ones that spring to mind at the moment.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Cathy. Really appreciate you taking the time to share all your expertise. I realise we could have had a whole day event actually just looking at CRPD. In fact, many people have, and we probably will in the future. But it should have been really helpful to have that insight and a overview of what it looks like, some of those rights, and importantly, start to touch on how we can actually use it. In order to get change and to improve things and for disabled people in Scotland. So thank you so much, Cathy. Thank you everyone for joining us. Really appreciate it. And I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @HRCScotland. Thank you.